thank the organizers for having me here. I'm talking, first time talking to a lot of mathematicians, so I'm a little nervous. A lot of respect for mathematicians. But on the other hand, I am an engineer by training, originally mechanical engineer, then now I'm in biomedical engineering department at UC Irvine. So I actually debated on how to prepare this talk by myself, of course, and tried to put in all the math stuff in it, but I decided that's not a good idea, probably. So I kind of in between there. I put some things that we developed in terms of the theory, or at least observations, and then a lot of things are more phenomena, I think, observations that might at least help you, help me look into it with the more theoretical lenses. So this is the topic of my talk. It's about half of my lab. If we have time, like I mentioned the outline, there's another half that I might talk about a couple of things on another part of my lab, research projects.
Which one
yeah, this is my lab. This is out at Newport Beach. We had it last summer there, and I just wanted to make sure that I acknowledge the many students. Actually, these are undergrad students, believe it or not. I have seven PhD students now, a couple of master's students, and a postdoc slash project scientist. And a lot of the work here, probably 50% is from my 10 who just graduated with a PhD degree last December. As a biomedical engineering is, I guess, the key job description is bridging between different disciplines. So we have lots of collaborations with different departments and different institutes, including Singapore, Rice University, UC Davis, and so on. But we also work with a lot of biologists and chemists in different projects. So I just want to acknowledge that as well. So the outline here is a normal talk that I give, meaning I just wanted to give you the scope of it so that you know that there's these things available in case you're interested. So basically, I usually talk about how micro-nano, I think, could bridge between diagnostics and treatment in terms of the applications. And then I mentioned there's two main microfluidics disciplines in my lab, and one is the droplets, what I'm primarily talking about today. Another part is more like integrated circuit-like microfluidic chips, and if I have time, I might touch on a couple slides there. And here, I won't talk a lot about, but I wanted just to list them here. Again, it's at the end of the talk, if we have time, the different types of application projects that I'm applying technologies that I'm going to describe today. So, some introduction. I come from a traditional so-called microelectromechanical systems field. That's my PhD was in making micromotors, vibromotors. And after that, I worked on a medical device as I joined the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory for working on a mechanical release mechanism for treating brain aneurysms. So we started from the micro area, working with lithography top-down and so on. Then I learned that chemists have a lot to say on really important things, so we started getting into more nano things and collaborating initially and now starting to do some on our own in terms of fabrication as well as applying nano-scale principles. In biology, the reason in biomedical engineering, our prime analogous is the cell itself is like a micro type system, and its components are like nanoscale components, and so we're again starting to bridge between the different domains and dimensions as well. So again, now getting closer to the main theme here. So the motivation is like many others, lab on a chip. This is how the lab is today. This is how we meter fluids for microfluidic people. At least we all are familiar with slides like this, where we have flasks, test tubes. Pipettes and so on, and we also have automation tools like robotics, ways to speed up the process, but it's still, in terms of the minimum volume you can control, is still pretty large, I mean, typically in the microliter range, and the speed is still limited, especially when you're trying to do multi-step processes, it becomes very difficult. And of course, if you're talking about some diagnostics or medical application, cross-contamination infections are critical concerns. So microfluidics came about. I guess the theme here is how microfluidics works in nature as well as in microfluidic technologies. In nature, obviously, we see lots of droplets. We never see a droplet that's as large as a baseball and so on. There's a reason for that. There's obvious physics behind. behind it, and we all probably in this room don't have to explain a lot about that. But as far as nature goes, it's pretty, it's diverse, and so on. And in terms of microfluidic technology, our goal is a little different. We want it to be much more uniform, a little bit more boring, but hopefully reproducible, repeatable, and uniform size, uniform concentrations, and so on, all that good stuff. So I guess a little bit more background about microfluidics. We all know there's the typical laminar flow microfluidics, low Reynolds number. Microfluidics is controlled mainly by diffusion limitation. I mean, the mixing is completely driven by diffusion, no turbulent flow. Pretty much, I tell my students, it's like highway tracks, and all these cars stay in the same track if you're in laminar flow. They don't mix readily. They're all good drivers. And this can be sort of an analog comparison to the integrated circuit or circuits design, for instance. Fluids come together, you have pressure, you have resistance, you have flow rates, and you can relate them, and you can look at diffusion equations to see how much traveling distance before you have so much mixing. So it's really nice because it's like an analytical tool. You can predict and you can calculate where things go. On the other hand, it becomes the same nightmare for analog circuits comes about. It becomes very complex and difficult to design very more sophisticated circuits. And so, like the first talk this morning was a great introduction about droplets. I think another way to look at it is like it's really a digitized version of microfluidics. You take each of these fluids and you pack it into a digitized confined volume, and you start to be able to manipulate it in a more digitized fashion if you can come up with the related circuitry design architecture that allows you to control large numbers of data with simple components allowing you to process many at the same time. There was this, just to some of you that are not familiar with the field, there's a lot of literature out there, including, there's going to be a great talk by Darren Link and others on droplets. There's just many, many papers since the last 3-4 years. And so I just wanted to let you know this. I'm not acknowledging a lot of them in this talk, but I mean, of course, a lot of it is we're basically based on a lot of work from other people as well. So droplet bioassays is sort of the purpose, taking a drop and thinking of it as a reactor or as a test tube. Now, can we take advantage of the control? If we can control the size and control how they mix, how you put in this a very controlled volume, and you're talking about picoliter or less, picoliters or less, you can possibly, and this is all not necessarily trivial, you can possibly enable rapid mixing, homogeneous reactions, precision control of volumes, and precision, and as a result, there's precision control of concentrations. And hopefully the slides that I talk about will at least touch on some of these. A little more introduction. So emulsion typically is two. Oops, sorry. Let me put it on vibration, but not today. One of those things. Okay. So wake everybody up. Let's wake up more. So emulsion, microfluidics. Emulsion basically is two fluids immiscible coming together, and traditionally it's been used for a lot of food industry, pharmaceutical industry. And this is what usually the difference is that it results in a very heterogeneous size populations. Whereas in microfluidics, I guess the reason why we're doing it, and I'm trying to justify it, is we have the potential to make them one at a time and very, very controlled. If you want to take a very different size population and try to mix it with different reagents and control reactions at those picoliter sizes, people do that. And it's more of a chemistry or a statistical analysis, looking at mixing up, making emulsions, and looking at maybe single molecular. There's some people that work on single molecular detection, and they actually do this, and they basically mix up emulsions, and they look for drops that have maybe one single molecule, and then look at the detection there. However, it's definitely a more statistical type analysis, and very difficult to have analytical tools that way. Whereas potentially, you could you can control the mixing of different reagents and samples together, pinpoint it, and have it happen at a reasonably fast speed. And then, of course, analysis. a wide range of things, and it's very, very expensive to do analysis and come up with conclusions of what you've got. And again, you have potential knowing temporal and spatial, leave where they are, being able to save a lot of money as well there. So we heard about Electro Wedding today, a great talk by Ali, and then there's also another, I kind of categorize them in the active systems of droplet manipulation. There are actually more than this. There's thermal capillary and many more, but I just list these two, electrical-based, Electro Wedding and electrophoretic. There's a group out in, there's several groups, but one in Texas, and Peter Gascoigne worked on dielectrophoretic-based droplet manipulation. Today I'm going to mainly talk about passive systems. So our job as engineers, the goal is to try to come up with an integrated circuit like fluidic chip that can, much like the integrated circuit, have a common platform, and you can generate with the same platform fabrication and maybe design tools, you can come up with ways to manipulate these droplets on the chip. You can make them, you can mix them, you can have different inputs. Hopefully you have a microprocessor-like capability. And I will get into some of the reasons for that. The primary design that we have, it's everybody has a little bit different design of their droplet generation geometries. What we have that's maybe a slightly unique is having this so-called shear focusing point in our droplet generation. And we'll have some slides, next few slides we'll explain some of the reasons why we think this is useful for what we're trying to do. But the droplet generation comes down to a a minimal width point or a minimal orifice neck point, where that's the point where within a controlled range of flow rates, it becomes very stable in terms of generating at the same point all the time. So you generate droplets and they all break off pretty much at this minimal neck orifice. And maybe simple, you don't even need to do this finite element, but if you do it, you can find that if, in some of the other earlier work, there were more parallel outlets where droplets are generated, and they actually have very interesting physics. So basically, you would have some instability, a thread starts to form, and then maybe have some elasticity effects in it, because this in here, the maximum velocity is about the same. So you have this maximum velocity that's pretty much the same along the parallel channels, and that creates all sorts of interesting physics in terms of droplet breakoffs, different sizes, different breakoff dynamics. Whereas in our case, we actually don't want to have so much interesting things to observe. We want them to have them very consistently breaking off at one point, and that's where the maximum point is. This just shows us, some of the this device in close up. Basically, there's the pressure and the shear force. Combined effect, I mean, if you look at a cross-section of the break-off tip. One thing that happens is when you come down to the focus point, basically it's squeezed down, and then it gets the pressure gets released as it goes into the expanded area. And as a result, just using intuition and force balance, you would see that the force, if the Q oil flow rate is larger than the water flow rate, then this thread will start be sort of pushed back as this one gets dislodged, and so that assists, and that's why we have very, very stable generation of droplets at that local point. And this is pretty much nothing new here. Actually, people have, I think, many groups have talked about the oil flow rate relationship with the radius, and I think more talking this morning as well. It has a basically a not a linear, but a less of a dependence of the flow rate of the oil as the of water as flow rate as the oil flow rate increases, and that's basically because at that time the water flow rate so that's why it kind of tapers off at the higher flow rates. The water when you have lower flow rates, water actually controls the droplet size. When you're at higher flow rates, we observed that the higher oil flow rates, at the higher oil flow rates, the water flow rates doesn't change much. It's pretty much dictated by the oil flow rate in terms of size. At the lower flow rates, however, it's like blowing up a balloon. You have enough time to blow it up, so if you have a higher flow rate of water, it blows up a larger droplet. So we're just coming up with non-mathematical terms to describe what we're seeing. Hopefully some of you can come up with the mathematics behind it. So, I mean, this is, again, very old work a few years back, but I kept on using this because it's the same. Basically, you can just see with about the same design. These are very old masks, which is very rugged. But that's the beauty of this. You don't have to make beautiful lithography devices. Now we have much better devices, but at least at this point, you can see they all break off pretty much at that point. And with about the same device, you can change the sizes without changing the geometry of your flow channels. Just a little bit more observation that as the droplet is generated, and this morning had a lot of insight about what happens here, but I'll just kind of continue on those lines. A droplet coming in has a width to length ratio, if it's a so-called slug-like droplet. Comes to this junction, if its critical capillary number is exceeded, then it will break off into two, and we'll talk about fission criteria. We're actually writing a paper on some in it, this basic general rules that we found in terms of geometric parameters that control that. And then we could have the sorting coefficient, like this morning, that was a very elegant description of the phenomena, alternating droplet phenomena. Anyhow, we do the same thing. We control the geometry downstream to control the flow rate and the resistance on two channels, and use that to control what happens at this junction. We also worked on, and this is again, I wish I would put on newer stuff, but we have another paper that we're trying to write up in the sorting, as I mentioned, is really taking this to much more sophistication in terms of what happens when two different sizes come to a junction. We found there's some general guidelines. One is the shear rate, mean velocity over the width, the velocity gradient, and shear stress. According to shear stress, then results in shear force. So upper shear force and lower shear force dictates how things happen. So a smaller droplet, if it's in the gray area, shaded area, will just follow the flow path because the upper area, or it could be included exclusively on the bottom channel, or as long as it's sort of on the bottom, where the cross-section area of the upper flow stream versus the lower flow stream is less than the bottom, the down area, then you have the droplet, the shear force just moves the droplet downwards. The larger droplet is experiencing opposing forces. One is, of course, the shear force, again, area. The area, even if it's larger on the bottom, the D, which is the shear rate, could be higher on the top. And so the larger drops, and this is something I can't describe in very precise terms, but the droplet is deformable. And typically what we find is as long as the shear rate is larger, we pull the larger droplets, even though they're exposed to, the shear rate, the shear forces become larger. And so you can use this phenomena, and we have used this with, I think, a very, hopefully a very nice paper coming out to sort droplets based on their size and with similar conditions, flow rate and everything else. Yes?
So in that picture, that's assuming the small droplet is in the bottom.
Or mostly on the bottom, meaning the ratio.
But so when you do the experiments, I mean, is it gravity? Why are the blocks? Because I would think the small droplets would be sort of uniformly
in the middle.
Distributed, yeah.
You'll see in the further down that we intentionally push it down now.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So then we'll guarantee it. Otherwise, it's more statistical. So
yeah.
Some go up, some go down.
Yeah.
So that was sort of some of the sorting ideas. In terms of the splitting, there's the equal splitting, of course. This is very slow. We had just some observation. This is actually, again, from I think the paper from the Stone's paper, Anna Stone's paper. They have this description of how the geometric effect you can describe by the so-called extension parameter, meaning the droplet versus channel width ratio, and with that you can come up with a curve that's the critical capillary number, and this just shows you, just the base measure shows that it matches that the width here. The capillary number and the width, you can see that this line here, as it approaches this line, the squares, these are the ones that break when it approaches this line, approximately at this boundary here, it starts to not break and start to just either deliver into one of the channels and not break. And then if you talk about asymmetric, which is a little more trickier, doesn't matter. You can now look at the capillary number. But this is a droplet when you have different resistance downstream and upstream, I mean, maybe different lengths or different, basically different lengths or widths downstream that allows you to have different resistances, and that breaks it up in very reasonably consistent asymmetric portions of the droplet. And I'm just wanted to mention here, so if it's asymmetric fission, the only thing I want to add here on top of the literature pretty much just says the resistance, a simple observation, which is true, that the ratio between the two daughter droplets are proportional to the ratio of the resistance of those two channels. We just found one extra observation. As you can see, this droplet is a little bit larger than this droplet, although they're at the same so-called extension. The resistance ratio is the same. So if the larger droplet, if that theory is completely true, then the larger droplet break off with the same conditions, this should be smaller because the total droplet is smaller. The ratio resistance is the same. So this should be even smaller than that droplet. We found that if there is also a component of the size of the mother drop that affects this break off. So it's not completely resistance dominant. And then this is probably obvious to some of you. And so you can now start to think about more sophisticated, we can break droplets down many, many times. And again, I don't know why, but this is pretty consistent. You're talking about something that's not very precise in terms of channel design. Droplets come in, and this is what amazes some of the people. They're just thinking statistically you're going to get a lot of variation in the droplet sizes, but we're not. We're getting reasonably uniform, and I actually don't have estimation here. But we can get very uniform breakup of droplets downstream, which means for practical applications, there's a lot. You can take the same droplet, break it up 1,000 drops, and then expose them to different things. So it's kind of nice. This here just is another phenomenon. Basically, droplets come into a junction. The total resistance downstream is the same. However, the local, as you can see, the local geometry is different. There is a narrower width on the top and a wider one on the bottom. When droplets come in here, you experience higher shear rate on the top, and so that's the different phenomena like I mentioned. Not only the flow rate difference, but also the shear rate difference. So the shear rate difference here dictates that the larger drops, that you break it up unevenly or unequally in terms of droplets smaller down here and higher up, and larger up there. So it's a shear rate difference. So that's fission, breaking drops. And we made drops, we broke drops, and now we're mixing drops again. I think Darren probably will have even more exciting movies to show. But here is what we've done. One of the projects we did was several ways to do fusion. One of the fusion ideas is here, where we have alternating droplets with two different, with the dye, you can see the darker and the brighter one. And this is pretty interesting, like a push-pull effect, where it's the same pump coming in, right? So one comes in, it kind of pushes the one other one back and breaks off a droplet. It's like two T-junctions at the same area. And so you come alternating droplets. And then we have this expansion geometry such that droplets in the front start to have velocity slowdown. There's a velocity gradient in there. And so the droplets have enough time to fuse before they get sucked into this smaller channel, which has higher velocity. So you get separation after they enter the small channels. And so we get fusion, and then you can suck it away, and then you can start to. So we're using this for some synthesis projects, chemistry, and we'll talk, if we have time, some of the applications, as I mentioned. Another way to do fusion, instead of this velocity gradient, is really to intentionally drain away the fluids in between the droplets. That's separate the droplets. So droplets come together, though they won't come together unless you suck away the separation fluids in between. So what we do is we have fluid drainage going up and downwards. And so that what happens is there the rate of that drainage causes the droplets, dictates as a relation to the droplet incubation time, as you may, the time that it's in this fusion junction, dictates whether it fuses, or whether two drops fuse, three drops fuse, or four drops fuse. So so we've come up with, actually we just submitted a paper that talks about this phenomenon. We can pretty much have very nice, this one we actually do have some math to describe the phenomenon of how in what kinds of situation criteria dictates that two drops fuse, three drops fuse, and four drops fuse. And I want
to ask a question.
Yes.
On the top thing, is it on purpose that you have a higher flow rate of a dyed liquid so that you make larger drops so they catch up with the smaller one?
No, not really. The main reason is the slight viscosity difference, is my guess. But no, we didn't intend to do that. So, and that's a good point, because what we wanted to do is equal size fusion, which is a bit more difficult, because people, you know, there have been papers talking about different sizes. The travel gradient will allow them to fuse. But this, I think, with this arrangement, that could be possible. So if we have two with the same viscosity, probably will have the same size, and they will, as a result, mix and fuse. This hopefully this paper will be published soon. Not getting into much of the details, but what we did basically is my student. Mainly, when the droplets come enter this junction, droplet fusion junction, there is a travel time from this point to this point, and also there is the drainage flow rate from, you know, like I mentioned, you can control the drainage flow rate up and bottom, and so that drainage flow rate dictates how fast you drain it dictates how much time you have to fuse. So if you drain it fast enough, they come together. Early enough such that within the time that it passes by this junction, you can fuse. And so we look at that criteria. The main, obviously, component is the drainage time. The time to drain fluids between two droplets has to be shorter than the time for it to travel from this point, from the inlet to the outlet of this fusion junction. So that's the main criteria. And we use the flow rates, we plug in the flow rates, and we come up with geometric effects that give us some observations. I mean, this is the first observation, is with the four, five different geometrical differences in different channel designs, either width of the channel or width of the fusion junction. We have pretty much found that all the droplet fusion occurs above this TR over TD greater than 1, which is what I just mentioned. The drainage time should be shorter than the travel time. There's a few other things we did, and this is one of them. Just look at the frequency of generation, droplet frequency generation versus the droplet size criteria, and we looked at basically what makes it such that droplets, two droplets fuse, three droplets fuse, and so on. Next I'm going to talk. That basically talks about generation. Talked about fission, fusion. Now this is satellite drops, which is a kind of more specialized purpose. Many of us know, there's the satellite droplet. It's very hard to avoid. It's been a problem in the past for inkjet printers. Satellite droplets cause the smearing and limits the resolution. Here we're trying to see, since we can generate pretty uniform shear rates that we can control, or relatively uniform. Actually, we have a recent might be able to get to it later. That talks about when our syringe pumps are not uniform in terms of the flow, or not uniform enough for some application. But anyways, here the satellite droplets being generated. The mother droplets are pretty uniform. We generate the satellite droplets. We use different kinds of geometries. Either trap them in these geometries where they have these so-called trapping zones for satellite droplets, or we have ways to kind of contain the small droplet and sort them based on similar to criteria what I mentioned earlier in terms of that sorting, shear rate versus flow trajectory. This highlights a little bit of the ideal situation. Obviously, is you want to break off cleanly and have one drop made. In reality, that doesn't happen. There's always this tail of fluids that causes so-called, and this is most likely Rayleigh's instability, the thread of liquid, this elasticity of the surface tension is sort of pulling it together, and this is again my student's artwork here. So So that plasticity causes, you know, eventually instability that causes breakup of the droplets and creates satellite droplets. So just most of our videos have this phenomena shown. Is this gonna work? It's not. No? Just try one more. Oh, yeah, so you can see satellite drops being, yeah, there's that satellite drop. So we just thought, I mean, there's some applications where we want to make truly submicron droplets. This is probably not the best way to do it, but on the other hand, this is one way to do it, is making droplets that are, you know, more micro in size, but then the satellite droplets are controlled such that they are in the more submicron regime, and we've been able to make it pretty small. So we just, you know, that previous question about how do you control where that smaller droplet goes, and this is basically maybe a little bit cheating, but what we do here is we control such that we have a slight imbalance between the upstream and downstream and distorts the thread a little bit upwards. And so the small droplets stay up there. The larger ones have the hydrodynamic focusing effect more close, pushing it towards the middle. And we'll be able to have the small droplets always stay on top, and then we can separate them downstream. So that's the idea. So this is basically showing that effect. The small droplets stay on top. So this is pretty dramatic effect here when you make lots of droplets. You see the small droplets being, this is my computers. Yeah, and you get the idea. So small droplets get collected downstream here on the bottom in the large droplets. Larger droplets go forward. And this is another, probably works a little even better, except it's just slow. You can see that we have this, instead of going left and right, we have a reservoir that's on the bottom. It's a multi-layer fluidic device where you have a smaller satellite droplets being collected downstream on the bottom reservoir, and you can collect them probably a little easier and collect a bunch of them. I won't get into this, but we further found that it's not that easy. They're actually in larger droplets, there's primary satellite droplets and secondary and tertiary, so you have to further separate them if you want really mono dispersed. So it's not that simple, but we were able to do some of that in terms of separating even the satellite droplets further. So this shows at least what we can do. We use basically an imaging program to look at the size, at least estimate the size. It's not the most accurate way to do it. We have other techniques that we should probably use. But the primary satellite droplets in the 2 to 3 micron range in this case, and it really depends on your mother droplet and other parameters, and that's something we haven't done a lot of research in. What conditions make what size satellite droplets? Secondary satellites around 1 to 2 microns. The tertiary ones are in the 0.2 to 0.4 type of micron range, so 200 to 400 nanometers. So I kind of just some observations. It's unavoidable to have satellite drops. They're pretty similar, pretty controllable. We can repeat it, will always be the same if you have the same conditions. And you can, because it's really a singular point eventually when it breaks off, so you potentially can get down to really small. And right now we're not yet there in terms of clean monodisperse satellite drops that we want to get in terms of getting the 100 nanometer or less particle sizes that we're looking for. So with all these techniques, I mean, there's a few others that I'm not going to be able to talk about today, but we're thinking about how do we use it for different applications. One thing that people want to do is really have a true concentration gradient or a combinatorial type of assay method that's programmable. Many groups have published things like having different multiple streams come through each droplet. This is another similar or a different way to do the same thing, is having droplets have initial so-called initial concentration gradient geometrically top and bottom. You have a dark and it's like an yin-yang kind of configuration, and then when you start to split them, the ones on top and bottom will start to separate many times. You have start to have a concentration gradient along the different splitting points. so that the simplest way to do it is, you know, like the Ismail Galaf group in Chicago and others, is just having two fluids coming together in each drop, coming out, and then what we want to do is have some observations. There are many people did it differently. What we did was we came up with a very nice control scheme of a very, I guess they call it zero dead volume, I say minimal dead volume micro valve or mount valve that controls the fluoride, such that you can pretty much, this one's not the best, but you can see we control it fairly well. Probably the first droplet is somewhere above this, maybe that's the third droplet or so. So you can trap them in their tracks, is the idea. Just trap these droplets, generate the droplets, and have a concentration gradient as you ramp the fluids, flow rates, and that can enable you to generate so-called droplet arrays.
How do you do the valve?
It's like a Y kind of valve where you have this, it's a Lee valve company.
Okay.
Yeah, so control. It's nothing fancy, but it took a lot of time just to make sure we stop it. We can do pretty good control and stop it right in tracks without, I guess most people just pull off the tubes. At least that's how we used to do it, just pull off the plugs. But then you disturb like the top 50 droplets or 20 droplets along the way. This is just an example of what we did in terms of, this is just showing, this is not yet trapped, but droplets being pushed in this meandering channel. It's a fluorescence image, so you can see, you don't see the channels themselves, but they're coming back and forth, droplet traveling downstream from this, or this maybe traveling upstream from here. So the idea is to come up with something that's like a microarray for genes, and we can have a droplet array that has screening purposes. This shows them I'm pretty sure this is trapped, but we have trapped many times. So green and red fluorescence dyes coming to each droplet, and we're able to trap them. And you can see if you use the filter to look at only in green, the concentration is going downward in downwards direction, and the concentration gradient is the opposite way with the red fluorescence dyes. This couple groups have talked about this, and we actually didn't get a chance to publish in a journal paper, but we talked about this in a, well actually we talked about it as an example in one of our papers. But so now one application is, you know, there's many things you can do. Maybe taking protein and salt, mixing them into each droplet, ramping their concentrations such that you find the right combination where the crystals grow the best, or they crystallize the best. It's like a solubility mapping technique. So we're not quite there, but if we continue to push this, eventually the idea is we can now come up with a way to quickly generate a solubility map or phase diagram that allows you to quickly find out what are the sweet spots for protein crystallization instead of wasting a lot of time looking at the whole domain. That's the parallel method. In terms of the serial method, this doesn't seem too fancy, but if you think about it, this is one nice way of looking at taking something that's a temporal phenomena and very difficult to observe in a macro chemistry type of way, and put it into a linear dimension. So what I'm trying to say is, if you have two things that react, in this case it's actually hybridization of molecular beacons and targeted genes. So we have these two coming together. You can actually look at, and there's many ways to look at, there's many ways to things to screen. You might screen screen single base pair differences, or you have, you know, a mixture of samples and the target genes. Anyways, the idea is they would hybridize, and they will travel in a fixed velocity. So the length of when this hybridization or this color change saturates is the time that it hybridizes, at least it completely hybridizes to the extent that chemistry allows. And that gives you just that. So you do a so-called continuous exposure, allowing you to look at that. You measure that length, then you know basically the hybridization time. And so you can do lots of kinetics studies with this kind of phenomena. So this is the idea. Basically, you come in, and you can look at when it saturates. And we actually in another paper being submitted right now. And to do that, we have to do a lot of groundwork, legwork, and Ismail Galaf has done a lot of work, but we have to repeat some of that work. As you can see here, this is a fluorescence image, or enhanced fluorescence image. If you have a straight channel, straight droplets, I mean droplets traveling in a straight channel, and you have a concentration gradient from the top and bottom, meaning fluorescence on the bottom, no fluorescence on top, and the continuous exposure of the fluorescence, you can see that pretty much the fluorescence in this limited travel length stays on the bottom. There's no mixture here. Whereas just having this zigzag pattern here allows the mixture, the convection of maybe the interfaces, eddy currents occurring that allow you to completely mix within the two or three turns. So it's a really nice way to do mixing in terms of a droplet kind of volume. And this shows some results from that hybridization experiment where you can see for the two micromolar DNA, we just adjust the the two micromolar molecular beacon mixed with different concentrations of DNA, we can see what we predict is that there's a base one where there's no matching or there's no non-specific DNA or molecular beacon only, there's no signal, and as you start to put in different concentrations of DNA, you get the signal start to go higher and higher, and so you, again, the kinetics, the idea of this kind of verifies the idea to measure kinetic reactions with this kind of a design. So another application we use a lot is the synthesis of different materials, and there's a whole range of projects I won't be able to get into. This is one of the earlier ones, which we did cadmium sulfide synthesis again, after a couple other groups synthesized. But this is based on that fusion device. So the droplets come together, they fuse. And then you trap them in their tracks, and then you look at this becomes basically a micro droplet reactor, and you look at how these little nanoparticles start to crystallize out, synthesize out. And the idea originally was a grand goal that this, because we're instantaneously fusing, and this fusion process, we can have other observation that's very rather rapid mixing effect, will give us such uniform mixing of two reagents with stoichiometric, or at least some control of stoichiometric, that we will get very uniform nanoparticle sizes. Then later when we found out it's limited by aggregation and other chemistry effects. But the physical part of it, I think, is really nice. If your chemistry allows you to get very clean nucleation type of things, where you require very uniform mixing right away, then this is a way to go. I want to talk about one more thing at least before we end. One more technology for these applications. So we can use this droplet to encapsulate cells and many other things as well. This shows upstream, we have this, these are neuroblastoma cells, and then come downstream, we start to push them and we encapsulate the cell. We can then actually, we'll have another device that later will polymerize these droplets into, in our case, it's alginate, become alginate beads encapsulating cells for potentially tissue engineering applications. We're also working on other polymers to do the same thing. You can imagine different types of cell-based therapy can use that same phenomenon. This just shows pretty consistent encapsulation of a controlled population of cells. And in this case, this was later turned into alginate. So again, lots of particles. There's some application, a lot of particles. This is actually Raman SIRS molecules SIRS detection. Raman molecules, different Raman molecules we encapsulate for a biosensor project. We've been able to synthesize PLGA, which is biodegradable polymer in nanoparticle sizes. We also made non fluidic emulsions. This is actually a gas, a bubble emulsion, and we've been able to make that in our microfluidic channels for medical applications. So this is what I wanted to talk at least briefly before. So what really motivated me initially is to work on this area is not droplets themselves, because I mean I had no interest or even no idea that it was interesting before. What we wanted to do earlier was I saw some ways people make liposomes. Some people call it artificial cells, and I saw how they made them, and it looked like it's something I can make in a microfluidic channel. So that's triggered my whole motivation of this. And then later I had to go back to do droplets and come back to this. So, and this is how cell, I mean, the motivation again is as I learned a little bit more about cell biology, and I only know very little, I found that a lot of the things that are happening in the cells are very compartmentalized, meaning all the reactions, the protein synthesis, everything is kind of, or even nutrients coming in, waste going out, sending signals back and forth, immune biosensing, comes out of these vesicles moving around in this very busy cell, moving around, and each of them have like a digital reaction. That's why we have such, I think, in a way, we compartmentalize these reactions and they happen, and at those scales, the diffusion is fast enough, so you have a lot of very sophisticated reactions happening in there. And so I thought if we can make things similar to the cell and maybe smaller, then we can start to generate reactions that mimic more of how biology works. So this is something I drew before we made anything, is that the idea of maybe having fluidic being sheared and coming up with the first level inverted emulsions and then later on coming up with the fluid liposomes. And so these are actually the, this is inverted vesicles. This is the completed liposomes that we made. They're giant liposomes and they're pretty stable. We haven't verified it yet, but it seems like it's more stable than ways than the way you make it in a more conventional emulsion stirring type of, or shaking type of method. So I won't limit the time, but the idea is you have emulsion, you have a droplet generator, so that controls the size. It's in, the continuous stream is actually lipid-containing solvents. They start to form the first layer of the lipids, and then you send it through, you know, through this interface that allows you to generate the lipid vesicles. And we've
How
made.
How do you send it through the interface?
Okay, that next slide will come. But that that's something in the microfluidic sense we're still working on. We just actually had a paper accepted for JAX. It's not getting there yet. It shows next plot. This shows basically it. It's basically just droplets generated having the first inverted lipids coating around the droplet, and then we actually exchange the out. We basically just put it in a ethanol H2O mixture, and that pulls away the long-chain lipids in the solvents, leaving back the short chains. And then the water is, you continue to just dilute it. Eventually you get the droplets that match the size of the liposome that match the size of the microfluidic generated droplets with double layers, or not yet confirmed, but we're pretty sure, we're thinking that it's double layers, bilayer kind of lipid coatings.
Well, it either is or it isn't, because it's in water, it's just the inside, it can't be a monolayer.
Yes, but it could be multiple layers.
It
could
be multiple layers.
Yeah. So
these aren't going through an interface now, right? They're
not really going through an interface. We're exchanging.
You're just doing the solvent exchange.
Solvent exchange, yes. Mm-hmm. And so right now we're obviously trying to work on the continuous processing in the microfluidic kind of version. These are not movies, but these are the lipids. It kind of looks funny when it touches. It's a little bit different from the true droplets. We've encapsulated various different things, beads, nanobeads, proteins, even cells. So I think probably there's not, maybe this is the only way, or maybe one of the few ways you can actually blow a bubble around a cell. So I just want to show the results of these things. So we were able to encapsulate cells in these liposomes with this method. We were able to put in GFP, of course, encapsulated for 28 days. They still are fluorescent, so we're not hurting the proteins. The cells, we have assays, and we were kind of rushing for the journal purpose. For a few hours, we were able to still perform viability tests of the cells and prove that they are still viable and they're not, you know, the shear force or anything else did not kill it, and so we encapsulate a cell. So it's really a large liposome around a cell, which is, again, large liposomes, I've been told, and again, I don't know exactly the physics, are much less stable than the smaller counterparts. But we were able to do that, and we put fluorescence beads and so on. We're also, of course, trying to derivatize different types of molecules on the surface of these lipids. And so we can potentially do target therapy, targeted delivery types of or target imaging types of applications in medicine. And oops, so I'll talk. So I have another project. Since it's this, I guess we're talking about flow in nature. I thought this was my other part of my lab. It's not so relevant, but I'll mention a couple of things. One is we're working on a project to use microfluidic devices and various electrical components to separate sort cells based on their dielectric properties. And the motivation is there are certain types of applications, for instance, neurostem cells, which we are working on, that don't have when they are precursor cells or when they are still stem cells, they don't have a specific biomarker that you can just tag and say, well, this is red, let's use a flow cytometer to separate them out. We actually don't know exactly, but there are already some changes in them that dictate that they're gonna probably be more prone to become a certain cell type versus another, meaning the neurostem cell may become astrocyte or oligodendrocyte or a neuron, and we want them to become neurons, for instance. So we want to find out what are the pre-populations that we can sort based on its dielectric properties. And we hypothesize that because, again, these are neuron and are brain cells, so there are more electrical components, ion channels in there. And so there might be a difference in that membrane distribution of proteins that will dictate its dielectric properties. And then we can use that to separate them. Again, this is a little bit premature to talk about, but we have pretty good success in sorting the cells based on dielectric properties. We're trying to prove that it can be as sensitive to separate out these neurostem cells. The main technology from an engineering point of view is that we've come up with vertical electrodes. These red, this black is the channel, red is the electrodes. They're vertical along the channel. They're actually, we now can make them pretty beautifully aligned vertically on the channel, about 30 to 40 microns high, and we can generate magnetohydrodynamic forces to magnetic fields, and electrical current allows you to get Lorentz force generated to push the flow, like pump, or you can use dielectric forces and combine it with pressure-driven flow so you can separate cells in a lateral direction. So the key here is to have a vertical channel, a vertical electrodes allowing you to come up with a very versatile chip. It's actually pretty brute force, but it works. We basically do electroplating, have very nice polymer, like SU8 type. You can plate very vertical channel, very beautiful, and control the plating rate. And then we take that off, and there's just some tricks to make it so that we take it off very cleanly, put on another layer, and then we have another technique that allows us to seal it. So we actually seal the channels completely over this, because the topography, you can imagine, has a little bit of unevenness, so any other kinds of sealing method has to have a flexible membrane. So we have a PDMS carrier wafer and press it together. It allows us to generate. I don't have the latest pictures, but hopefully, you know, if you're interested, I can send it to you. The lot of advantage of having this vertical electrode, meaning uniform electrical fields and so on. This shows earlier versions of it. It's not as nice, but you can see the idea. Electrodes, and you can now look at a circuit with both the fluidic channels and electrodes that are vertical. This is an early version of the electrodes vertically being plated and also connected by these thin film electrodes. This just shows not the separation, but just shows the idea of, you know, cells coming. These are cells. They're coming in. They're randomly placed in the drum. And you apply a fuel, and it actually starts to line them in. You can imagine how we might be able to separate cells in the lateral direction as you do that, because you can position them in different places. That was MHD. I won't talk here, but actually I did want to talk about this because this is probably more interesting from a theoretic point of view. We're trying to push the limits in terms of detection, electrical detection on a surface binding event, as opposed to optical detection. There's SPR, there's the Raman spectroscopy, but in terms of electrical detection, we've come up with a method that we think we're starting to prove this, but we're still working on it. Basically, when there is flow and electrical field is in here, the noise and other things are going to dominate the impedance factors there, so you can't really measure anything happening at the surface. But we're using a flow versus no flow differential pattern, then actually what happens is the flow induces a charge transport, and I guess next talk, one's talk, we'll talk a lot about this, the theories behind this, but there is this double layer charge layer. When there's flow and non-flow, that charge layer starts to move, and that you can, if you can pick up that so-called admittance change and compare it with a binding event versus a non-binding event, you might be able to have a pretty sensitive electrical-based detection of binding events. And that's what we're trying to develop, is a protein protein array sensor based on electrical detection. And so hopefully we'll have some nice results to talk about next time. So anyways, in conclusion, I talked mostly about this droplet platform using micro nanofluidics, micro being the droplet, and then some of the components you might put in there, like an artificial cell. And I think the droplets have many applications that we'll hear throughout this workshop, including assays, sensors, making particles for therapies, and so on. Smart vesicles allow you to study biology, maybe more mimicking of the true biology in terms of volumetric sizes. And then I touched a little bit about my other part of my lab in terms of electrical microfluidic components. And if you ever go further south, you can come